This is CliffCentral.com.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon, you're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show. You're with me, Greg Nicholson. Your regular host, Kingsley Kapoori, is out of the province today, so we're going to be handling things. I'm joined by my colleague, Richard Poplack. Richard, how are you doing?
How are you, Greg? And hello to the listeners.
I'm all right. I think today we're going to have a little bit more of a therapy session than discussing politics. I think after last week, we need to just debrief and sort of get on the couch and talk about things. So for those who haven't been reading Daily Maverick, you should start and read more and share widely. But last week, of course, was the ANC's fifth National Policy Conference,
yeah.
Held out at Nasrec in Soweto, Johannesburg, and we had the pleasure?
Let's not misuse words. It was not a pleasure. In fact, it was horrible. It was horrible for a number of reasons. Primary among them, I'd say, is that Nasrec is not exactly the most welcoming facility on the planet. It's built out of concrete and looks like it was made by the devil himself to make journalists uncomfortable.
The devil when he dabbled in architecture.
Exactly.
So before we get there, let's sort of set the scene for this conference, sort of going into it, right? I don't think it's an overassumption to say, or I'm overstating it, to say that the ANC has been in disarray. The president has been loosely, or at least his son, linked to all these Gupta emails, which every day we've got a new leader of state-owned enterprises, government ministers, high-ranking ANC officials and their family members being linked to basically allegations of corruption that, as we're reporting them, could almost basically go straight to court and proceed on strong corruption charges. And
100%. Then
we've got different factions of the ANC attacking each other in public. We've got, you know, on the one side, you've got the MK Vets, the Youth League, the Women's League, going hard at what we call ANC stalwarts. Mm-hmm. Guys like Pravin Gordhan, Cyril Ramaphosa, they're just at each other's throats, which I actually can't remember happening in all my time covering the ANC. Mm-hmm. There might have been some of this, you know, in the lead up to Mangung, but it's intense at the moment.
No, nowhere near this intense, no.
To add to that, we've got this total shit show in the economy. And, you know, we've been downgraded to junk status.
Yep.
Unemployment is it record highs, or is it record highs for the last 10 years?
Record highs for the last 10 years. But again, we don't look at real unemployment, I don't believe, which is significantly higher. Mm-hmm. I think what they're saying is by 2018... The net unemployment will be at around 29%, which will be, I think, the highest ever. Mm. The official unemployment. Unofficial will be much, much higher than that, I think, nudging into the 40s, which you know, equates with middle-income economies that are in complete crisis, like Greece. You know, countries that are well acknowledged to be in a complete economic meltdown. We're in a recession. Just to add to your litany of disasters, we're in a recession. Crime stats have crept up. Obviously, the violence against women has sort of flared up this year in no uncertain terms. I think I mentioned to you a couple of days ago that every time I go out and ride my bicycle, I come across the sort of archaeological remains of a very, very recent protest. We're talking about communities all over the country. On Sunday, I was by Hout Bay in Cape Town, in the East Rand, in the West Rand, anywhere in Gauteng you name. Coming here today, I had to avoid the N3. The country is slowly creeping towards a sort of net ungovernability, and that's the sort of context that this fifth policy conference encounters.
And then to mention a couple of other ANC issues, the ANC obviously lost the key metros in Johannesburg, Tshwane, Nelson Mandela Bay, as well as a number of other areas around the country in last year's elections. And the alliance with COSATU and the SACP is looking as fractured as it's ever been.
Yeah.
Let's go back just a little bit before the conference started. Did you have any hope that either would see any positive policy proposals for what, you know, the ANC calls organizational renewal, the ANC being able to self-correct, or for the ANC coming up with any ideas about actually solving all of these or any of these problems that we've been mentioning?
Well, I mean, there's one sort of fundamental conundrum that comes in when you're talking about ANC policy or organizational renewal, and that is that the National Development Plan is effectively the ANC's policy. So you have this policy framework that has never been implemented and has barely been opened by anyone within the organization to so far as I can tell. That's the ANC's policy. So now we're entering into the conversations. We've been handed the 9 documents. We were handed that in January or February, Greg. Mm. I can't remember.
It was February. Around sort of earlier in the year when I've had rolling sort of press conferences supposedly to brief us on that, but they always get distracted on all this other shit going on.
Exactly. But we dutifully read those 9 policy points, and in some cases they appear to be tweaks of what was already established policy. But we knew going into this policy conference that effectively it was a proxy battle for the two factions within the ANC. We have what we'll call the constitutionalists on one side, Ramaphosa and his faction, Derek Kanakom, Pravin Gordhan, the Stalwarts, and some of the more centrist or right-wing ANC ANC cadres. On the other hand, we have what we call, and I use very big scare quotes in this, the radicals. In fact, I'd argue that they're reactionaries. But the radicals who are intent on cracking open the Constitution and circumventing the Constitution in order to ostensibly radically transform the economy. But as we've seen and as we've proven at the Daily Maverick and with our friends at Amabungani, without a shadow of the doubt, the project is effectively one of systematically looting state-owned enterprises for the enrichment of a very, very narrow set of cadres and their backers, mainly the Gupta family. That's the battle lines. Those are the ones that have been drawn. And to say, was I expecting any substantive policy conversations or organizational renewal precepts to be put on the table? Absolutely not. Mm. We got, I think, what any thinking person would have imagined we would get, and that is a full-blown war.
I think for me, before the policy conference started, I think it was the day before or 2 days before, I covered this press briefing from the 101 ANC stalwarts, who have spoken out strongly against what's happening in the party. And effectively, they called for a consultative conference.
Correct, yeah.
Which I'm not sure if a lot of people know, but have had a few of them in the past, as we know, about in the ANC, where they essentially just have a sort of conference to sit aside and say, look, things aren't good at the moment. We need to deal with what's going on right now before we actually take things forward into another conference, which will just be sidelined and distracted. Mm-hmm. And the SACP has called for something similar. Mm-hmm. For me, when this idea was essentially rejected, that was when it was clear that we're going to see more of the same. Because the argument for such a consultative conference is that you can't have the same guys running a conference, that they're implicated in all of the scandal, all of the problems of the party, and then hope that they will end up sorting everything out. It just doesn't work that way.
No, self-regulation never works, right?
That's right.
It just doesn't. I think one of the key sort of historical moments that the ANC, that the current ANC seems to point to, is the Mogorogoro conference in 1969, which was a reset of an almost 3-decade slide of the party. And it was this sort of reset button that is constantly referred to as the example of the fact that the ANC has its own sort of rejuvenation elements built into its organizational structures. And on the first morning of the policy conference, right before dropping a very explosive diagnostic document, a diagnostic report on the on his fellow ANC cadres, Secretary General Gwede Mantashe spoke to me about this notion of organizational renewal. When I said to him, "Look, isn't this policy conference just going to be another proxy battle? Why are we here? Why are we subjecting ourselves to NASREC, of all places?" And once again, he referenced the disarray leading up to 1969, and the sort of rejuvenation that occurred in Mogorogoro, which ended up with the liberation of South Africa in 1989, or 1990. So, that's kind of what we were being pitched from the outset. But it clearly seemed that was impossible.
And it doesn't seem to be any willingness to have such a conference like that 1969 example. Like, I think it's fascinating back then how, so, you know, the now much celebrated struggle leader, Chris Harney, mm-hmm. was the author of what was called the Harney Memorandum,
yes.
where he submitted to ANC leadership, he and I think it was six or seven other comrades, submitted to ANC leadership a document outlining all of the problems they had in the camps
mm-hmm.
and what was going on in exile and all of the rot that he saw would prevent them from achieving their goals of liberating South Africa.
Yes.
He and his other comrades were basically lynched for that,
mm-hmm.
and they eventually got back into the party after this conference was held. But it's funny looking at now how things are going on, where anyone who almost speaks out is seen as a traitor.
As a traitor. And I mean, I think two very interesting
things. Without realizing the irony of not learning from that lesson.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, while talking about that lesson constantly, this organization can renew because of, you know, look back at the Harney Memorandum, look back at Mogorogoro, look at this. So what happens on the first day of the policy conference? The first thing is the diagnostic report, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Will the diagnostic report be adopted and discussed, or will it not be adopted and discussed? What is involved in the diagnostic report? Well, first of all, it actually name checks the Guptas. It says this organization has been captured by a family
mm-hmm.
called the Guptas, and we need to deal with that significantly. We need to deal with corruption. We need to deal with factionalism. We need to deal with the buying of branches. We need to deal with a whole bunch of stuff that is impeding the growth of the organization. This stuff needs to be discussed. And that's the first sort of major factional battle that takes place at the conference. But at the same time, Jacob Zuma, in his opening address, goes after the stalwarts pretty hard. Calls them, I think he actually referred to them as so-called stalwarts.
That's right.
I mean, we're talking about 101 of the organization's most revered figures. People who really were in the trenches, who really did fight for the liberation of this country. And there were many, many, many people in the ANC delegations who did not fight for the liberation of this country. They're professional milkers. But we're talking about real people who said, we have a problem here. This organization is not working. We need to fix it. And Jacob Zuma went after them and effectively mocked them in his opening address in a way that was, I would say, extraordinarily distasteful. And I think that set the tone for the entire policy conference.
Mm-hmm.
Among those 101 stalwarts, that for sure they've taken way, way too long to speak, but there's some really respectable folk, and I thought it was disgusting.
I think not only that, in his opening address, Zuma also went off script and questioned the role of the courts in democracy,
yes.
Essentially saying that opposition parties lose votes in parliament, so they take their issues to the courts where they win in the courts, mm-hmm. and he kept on asking, is this the sort of democracy we wanted? We have to debate this thing, which is essentially, and obviously it's impossible to ignore, that the president keeps on being held accountable to the, and his comrades keep on being held accountable by the courts. So it looks like he's coming after the one institution
right.
that is actually able to hold him to account. But before we get into some of the more detailed issues from the policy conference,
mm-hmm.
are you able to just describe for us what it was like as journalists at NASREC? Some of just your general observations, but also some of how we were isolated and heavily denied access to the delegates.
Well, I think there's another little bit of context here which is interesting, and that is that...
The theme park.
Well, there's the theme park, but there's also this, we'll get to the theme park in a moment. But there's also the context of Black First, Land First going to Peter Bruce's house right before the policy conference and making a statement. Again, Black First, Land First are Gupta proxies. I think we've established with nary a shadow of the doubt that they're funded by the Guptas, or at least through the Gupta sort of propaganda army, showing up at a prominent journalist's home and basically 20 of these idiots making a bit of a noise. Sunafenta, the SABC journalist who had been massively harassed by the SABC, she passed away. And there was a couple of other journalists as well who were either sick or had also passed away that week for causes unknown. But it seemed... There was a real grimness in the press room that I hadn't really encountered before. I mean, there's even among competing publications, there's a fair amount of bonhomie. We're all in the same We're all in the same bag. This just felt grim. And what effectively had happened, Greg, as you know, is that we were walled off. We were fenced off from the delegates. We're like animals in a zoo. So on the one end, there's Nazareth, where everything is happening. We had two opportunities to follow the deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa, around the actual convention floor, and a day later, the president himself. They did not take questions. They made a bunch of banal prepared statements. We could not interrogate them on what they said, nor could we ask them about the conference itself. And that was that. That was the only two times we were allowed into the grounds. So it was it set sort of a depressing precedent, especially coming into the electoral conference this December. I think we're going to be heavily denied access, and we had to work very, very hard to get information from our sources, and B, to capture whatever leaks we could to try to get some understanding of what was going on in this conference.
The lack of transparency, I think, was scary. And I remember when, on the last day, we were waiting to go inside. You know, they allowed us once again, you know, to rush up to the hall and go inside so we'd be able to see President Zuma's closing address. Mm. And there was a moment where I realized there was like a few of us journalists just standing around, you know, having a cigarette because we were, you know, waiting as you do. And I looked behind me and there was a security guard basically standing right behind us, clearly sort of guarding us.
Mm.
And so another ANC official walks over and says, "You can't take any pictures of the delegates." And at this point, none of us, the three or four people I was standing around with, had a camera with them. We just had our phones, you know, tweeting or whatever we were doing. And so the level of paranoia and secrecy, I just found bizarre. And it's particularly scary considering we're seeing the same things happen in state institutions.
I think the first time I noticed a real ramp up in the paranoia was in the Port Elizabeth launch of the local government election manifestos in PE last year, I think it was, Jack. I'm losing track of time. Mm. I have no idea what year it is anymore. And it was chilling. I mean, just covering Jacob Zuma on the grounds there, the security guards were, you know, real, real pushy. And that sort of started to give one a sense of kind of the ramp up in paranoia that's happened ever since then. And it's only gotten worse. There really is a us versus them mentality now that is completely entrenched in the relations between the government. The spokespeople have gotten more belligerent. And there was a real effort this time out at the policy conference to contain as many leaks as possible. And they did that very, very badly, and they'll continue to do that badly, because in a sinking ship, there is many a leak.
This policy conference, I think, there was a lot of talk about how the economic discussions would be a proxy battle for essentially between Cyril Ramaphosa's camp and Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma and President Zuma's camps ahead of the December ANC elections. And a lot of what was focused on was actually battles over language. So white minority capital versus minority capital. Radical economic transformation versus radical socio-economic transformation. Mm-hmm. And delegates, we were told, spent hours and hours debating this. And that's what, you know, a lot of these headlines were.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people out there, they would say, why does this matter? Who cares about these half one word differences when, as we listed before, the country is facing so many challenges right now?
Well, it's politics at its most banal and stupid, without question. But much as, you know, the ANC is not a democratic organization. No one should be fooled into thinking that. And effectively, what happens in these conferences is that the battle for who leads and who makes the decision is fought at the delegate level. I mean, I think that's clear to most people who observe the organization. So you have these old sort of old school Soviet Stalinist battles over terminology. Because what does the terminology suggest? Not that there's a serious idea to be questioned about policy, but that a certain terminology is linked to a certain faction, right? And one can get the sense of the momentum of the conference, of who has the weight of the numbers behind which particular terminology is adopted to explain a particular phenomenon, right? Now, if that doesn't make you want to hit your head against the wall, given the fact that they are, you know, the country's in a recession and food prices keep rocketing up, I don't know what will. I mean, it's just embarrassing and dispiriting to sort of come into contact with this kind of idiocy. That said, the Economic Transformation Commission, there were two of them, I think three and four, Commission three and four were Economic Transformation Commissions. You're exactly right. That's where the proxy battle for the soul of the party is effectively being fought. What are the key points? The South African Reserve Bank. That's one. A state bank. That's another. Is monopoly capital, everyone agrees on the fact that there's monopoly capital, is it white? Or are there other characteristics that describe this phenomenon? What does radical socio-economic transformation mean rather than radical economic transformation? I think the Cyril Ramaphosa camp would suggest that what it means is that radical economic transformation will transfer all of the funds from the current elite, the white elite, into the hands of a narrow black elite, whereas radical socio-economic transformation will be a much more broad-based program of redistribution and transformation. I've never heard it described that eloquently, so I don't know, maybe I should become a spokesperson for the ANC. But effectively, these are all sort of proxy battles that are attached to one camp or another. That is, we were very lucky in that we got some very good access. The Daily Maverick got some very good access inside the Economic Transformation Commissions, and we got a real sense of how vicious those battles actually were. And they were extraordinarily vicious, as you know. That is the war right there.
If we're looking at the Economic Transformation Commissions, we both sat through the feedback press conferences on that. First of all, reading sort of the tea leaves, which camp do you think it went to on these issues? Was it the Ramaphosa camp or the Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma camp? Because it's largely been interpreted as sort of an indication on some of these issues that Ramaphosa had actually garnered a bit of support.
Yeah, I think that would be one of the interpretations. We knew going in that this was 51-49. And no one knew who had the 51 and who knew the 49. We're very, very split. I think the Ramaphosa camp was quite shocked at how prepared the Zuma faction was, at how vicious they were prepared to push their initiatives, and at how much traction their initiatives got within these delegations. So I think that's number one. Our sources told us that they were shocked at how hardcore the Zuma faction came to play. That's number one. Number two, in terms of the adoption of specific terminologies like monopoly capital and radical socio-economic transformation, which seems to be the two major things that emerge from the Economic Transformation Commissions, that would indicate that things went Ramaphosa's way. That said, Zuma's a pretty good fighter, and rolling over on two things that effectively don't mean anything, where the substantive issues like cracking open the South African Reserve Bank, initiating the first steps of setting up a state bank, right? Those real substantive issues are, and of course we haven't even touched on land reform.
That's right.
Right? So those things were left for another day. Right? So it's very interesting to see how a couple of concessions have been made to the Ramaphosa camp while the real, real, real issues have been kicked for touch, effectively. And it's going to have to go down to the wire in December to see whether or not the Reserve Bank is going to be meddled with, whether or not the Constitution is going to have to be reworked in order to change the Reserve Bank's mandate, whether or not the Constitution is going to have to be, fiddled with in order to deal with the very real land issues in this country. So, you know, all of this stuff is pending.
So, on the proxy battles between the factions at the Economic Commissions, the conversation and actual real decisions has essentially been delayed until December.
Correct.
And we didn't see any real proposals come up to actually fix the economy either.
Nothing. So no one has said, other than sending the much-loved Melusi Gigaba out to mumble things to business delegations and sending them out to London and New York City and other sort of institutions where capital is exchanged. You know, there's no plan. There's no plan to fix this economy. Everything is effectively on hold until the electoral conference, which is remarkably dangerous. As we've seen today, I mean, the markets, the Rand took a bath today and the markets plunged.
Essentially, we know that to fix any of these issues and actually turn the country around, the ANC itself needs to be fixed, or we're going to continue declining and obviously who's in power will eventually change. But the ANC can't really tackle issues of actual substantive politics issues until it can deal with get its house in order. Did you see any indications on organizational renewal, on unity, on the electoral, its internal election process, that it has a strong commitment to sorting these issues out?
None whatsoever. I mean, the first issue and the most important issue is the buying of branches. So there's so much money sloshing around the ANC, especially from the Premier League provinces, the Free State and Mpumalanga the Free State and Pumalanga. Why am I drawing a blank? Doesn't matter.
Northwest.
Yeah.
Sorry, Ivan.
No, Northwest. Nasrec melted my brain. The money sloshing around from the Premier League provinces is so significant that it is going to have an effect on how branches vote. Rumors are emerging that about R1 million a pop is being paid out to branch heads in order to sway their votes going forward. So that's kind of where the issues lie. So in terms of real organizational renewal, what was the big pitch that was made? That was by the president, and he said, look, why don't we do it this way? The winner gets to be president, the loser gets to be deputy president of the factional battles. And that way we're all a happy family and we all get to stick together and there's no split in the ANC. It's a totally absurd suggestion.
It reminded me of when I heard this. So we read about it in the papers and stuff in the days before, and supposedly this policy was defeated. You know, it was well sort of, you know, as everything was, pushed forward to be discussed in December, but shot down, you know, by a lot of delegates in the commission. And now when Zuma, you know, goes off script again to
in his closing address.
In his closing address to essentially sell this proposal to delegates and excuse me. Say that he's willing to tour the country to back this proposal and visit branches. It just reminded me of a parent with their children, you know, saying, oh, okay, you've got a lollipop, I'll give you a lollipop too.
Yeah, it's just, even if it isn't your birthday, you get a present as
well. You get to also blow out the candles.
Everyone's a winner. It was absurd. The other thing, of course, is widening the top six to a top nine. So two deputy presidents and, I don't know, 15 general secretaries and deputy general secretaries. I mean, everybody is a winner. It's like how millennials were raised or something, you know, just for showing up, you get a prize. You know, well done. I mean, complete disarray, disorganization.
Just to play devil's advocate, why wouldn't that sort out the ANC's factional problems?
Well, just because you have a whole bunch of people from either side of the factional battle within one of these top six or top nine or top 50 institutions, we've seen with the NEC. I mean, effectively, the top six would become, you know, start chasing the NEC in terms of size and capacity. So again, it would just be another version of where the bun fight would take place. The president, and here's the key. So many of the policies, the hidden policies in this policy conference, accrue more power to the presidency. Mm. That's effectively what's happened over the course of this fake democracy, is that more and more power has been accrued by the executive, right? Has been handed over to the executive. So think about it. You have an executive holding even more power than he did with Zuma, right? So whomever he or she happens to be, that president has unprecedented executive powers, right? You have effectively what is a top 9, 12, 6 who are lame ducks, right? Sitting there under the presidency. But what you've done is, because the loser is still kept in the ANC, you've avoided a split.
Mm-hmm.
right? Everyone said, he suggested that the deputy becomes the deputy, the loser becomes the deputy because he's afraid that his camp is gonna lose. No, he's afraid that his camp is gonna win, and where the win becomes a loss is if the ANC splits, right? And the party has to now at the polls. The Zuma faction now at the actual polls has to go up against, let's say, for want of argument, a Ramaphosa centrist faction with even breakaway elements of the DA involved, mm-hmm. right? That's where he knows everything is gone in 2019. So that's why his proposal was made.
I don't know why it seems like this. Personally, it seems like a split is so hard to fathom, or even though I know there was COPE. I know we have EFF. Mm-hmm. KASATU has recently split. But still, it sort of seems... And I also, if I look at the situation rationally, it looks very possible. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of only until these things actually happen do they seem conceivable.
Yes, you're exactly right. I think we can look around the world to get a sense of how quickly and how vertiginously political watersheds can occur. And I mean... The most recent and best example, I think, is France with Macron. I mean, there you have a guy whose party did not exist, right? He comes in, he walks into the presidency, and then whatever rump party he cobbles together in the lower houses takes the day. And all of a sudden, the politics in France have been rewritten within the matter of, I think it was about 6 weeks.
Yep.
Right? With shocking rapidity. So I think we need to be very, very careful about saying that things can't change here, because they can and they will. How? I mean, we can't sit here and prognosticate right away, you know, here in this room.
Before we go, what should we be looking out for ahead of the December Congress?
Pretty much everything. I don't even know. Dragons? Unicorns?
One thing I'm looking out for is when Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma hits the campaign trail again. She's almost gone missing.
Yeah, she's gone missing. She
started out strong, yeah, and has just sort of, you know,
slept through both of Zuma's speeches on. You know what she looked? It looked like she was just like, I listened to this guy for 16 years when we were married. I cannot listen to another fucking word he says. That's what her face looked like to me. She just wants that guy gone, right? That said, when does she hit the campaign trail again? And that's definitely something to look out for. And again, watching her language and her choice of verbiage is going to be very, very interesting as she goes back to war, effectively. Watching Ramaphosa. He's also sort of, he hasn't been as quiet as she has, but he's also been a little bit quiet. And then the dark horses, right? Black and better. I mean, I'd call her a huge outside chance. But again, weirder things have happened. Zwelin Mkhize, watching him, I think, is interesting. So there's kind of lots of, I mean,
Lindiwe Sisulu, Matthew Sposa.
We've do this all day, right?
That's right.
Yeah, right down to, I don't know, Andile Lungisa. Yeah, you know, it's there's a big list. And then, of course, watching the Premier League, is that going to hold? Right? Are these two factions going to hold? Will a breakaway be flouted prior to the electoral conference, should the Ramaphosa faction realize that they're not going to go in there with anything approaching a quorum? Mm. So it's there's so much stuff that can happen. On top of which, we barely touch sides on those emails, right? There's other bombs we know news-wise are going to drop. Is one of those news bombs going to be the definitive one that breaks open everything and basically wipes the ANC out? I don't know.
So before we let you go, Richard, I was talking to one of the ANC delegates who attended the conference, and he was, I guess, was in despair that the ANC could not acknowledge the problems it's going through. Mm-hmm. And he essentially said that if the party can't acknowledge the challenges it faces right now, it can't do anything to rectify them. So the obvious question is, what's going to happen to the ANC? His answer was, the movement as we know it is going to die. Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
Yes. Yes, I do. So look, and I mean, there's many, many, many people in this country. And of course, we're ignoring the fact that the party has a massive rural base and will always have that rural base, I think, or at least for the next 15, 20 years. In terms of an urban party, it's dead. It's gone. It'll never regain these metros, I don't think. And effectively, it's in its death throes. And whatever emerges from it will be a very, very different beast. Again, very much a rural party based with its sort of plurality in KZN. Now, that shouldn't be surprising. I mean, organizations die. The Republican Party in the United States, another, for instance, from around the world, is currently leading. It's not the Republican Party anymore. Right? They're running the country, but they're not. The president is an outsider. He has no association with that party. And what he's doing is systematically destroying it with every decision that they make. So these things happen, and they happen in very, very weird ways. The ANC is part, once again, of what I would consider to be a much larger global phenomenon of these big establishment parties having been associated with so many scandals, having done such a poor job of managing the economy, of managing the social transformation issues in the country, that there's just no way they're going to last it out.
There you have it. Richard Poplack, Daily Maverick journalist. Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
To the listeners, please share this widely. Subscribe on iTunes or whichever podcasting app you happen to use.
Yeah, we're agnostic. It doesn't matter.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's the final word. Mm-hmm. Daily Maverick is agnostic.
Yes, exactly.
Tune in next week. We'll be with you soon. My name is Greg Nicholson. Stay tuned and have a great week.
Cliffcentral.com. This is Cliffcentral.com.